He understands the professional liability fund has always retained its own lawyers, so we thought we'd go ahead and clarify that in statute. I'd be happy to answer any questions. Lester Rawls would be happy to come down for the work session if the committee has any questions.
In the last session, didn't we do just about the opposite of what this bill does? Didn't we require...
No, we did not succeed in getting a bill passed last session. There was some issue in connection with that, and I don't recall specifically what happened on that.
Well, the person...
Well, I know it was active members of the state bar. I think there was an issue about that.
Okay. What about an active member of the Oregon State Bar who's also an active member of the Washington State Bar, and his office is in Vancouver?
Right.
Now, of course, professional liability insurance would be required of him.
No, he's not required to purchase it unless he's practicing law in Oregon.
Well, I mean, he comes over from Vancouver and goes into the Multnomah County Circuit Court, for example, and that kind of thing.
And he practices. Yes, he would be required to have insurance, and in that case, the fund would cover his work in Oregon. That one's a little bit unclear. I've talked to Mr. Rawls about that issue, and they're adopting some administrative rules to determine at what point a person is required to purchase the coverage, and at what point then the fund is mandated to provide, to defend the claim. Yes, this is happening more, as you know, with lawyers who are members of the bar in both states. What we want to prevent, obviously, is having to cover lawyers in other states for their practice in other states.
Yes, but if the member of the Oregon Bar who has a principal office in Vancouver, Washington, where he also practices law, does 10% of his practice in Oregon, the way I understand the bill, this fund would not be subject, the fund would not be involved.
That's right, and you're right. I'm rereading the bill. Subsection 2 of Section 1 says the Board of Bar Governors shall have the authority to require all active members engaged in the practice of law whose principal offices are in Oregon. So if that lawyer that you're talking about has his or her principal office in Vancouver but does practice in Oregon, but say only 10% or a little bit, then the fund, he or she is not required to purchase the coverage, and therefore the fund is not required to provide coverage or to defend a claim made against him. They're going to be adopting administrative rules to determine at what point someone does sufficient practice in Oregon to be required to purchase the coverage and therefore have the fund obligated to defend a claim. There is some ambiguity there, I agree with you.
Yes,
is it an ambiguity, or isn't it really just that if they have a principal office in Washington, they don't have to, and they practice half the time in Portland, they don't have to have.
That's the way I read it.
Well, there's a question, I suppose, if somebody does slightly more than 50% in Vancouver, a little less than 50% in Oregon, but goes ahead, purchases the coverage, is allowed to purchase the coverage, and I see under that kind of condition, the PLF would cover, defend a claim made. Sometimes it's difficult to determine when more than 50% of the person's time is spent in the other state. There's going to be some cases where it's a close call, in which case, it's my understanding from talking with Mr. Rawls that he anticipates that the fund would defend such a claim if the person had, in fact, purchased the coverage.
So, if I might.
Counsel.
So, my understanding is the way that this is written, a person who spends more than 50% spends 51% practicing in another state and 49% in this state is not covered by the PLF.
He's not required to purchase PLF coverage, but
then
he's not covered.
Not required to be insured in any way for the 49% of their time that they're practicing in this state for malpractice insurance.
they're not required to be covered by the PLF.
Or by anything else.
That's right. The only mandatory insurance requirement we have is the PLF requirement.
Any other questions? Okay, thanks. Anybody else here on 2259?
All right. We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2259. And we'll go to Representative Hill still in? Oh, come on up. We're going to take House Bill 2914. I thought I saw you, then you disappeared from my sight, and I kind of forgot about things here. 2914. Usually the visiting representatives sit right up in the front row so that they embarrass the chairman if the chairman doesn't call them quickly, see, but when you sit in the back of the room, it's hard for us to be embarrassed by your presence.
I'll keep that in mind. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, this is House Bill 2914, which is a bill I introduced at the request of a constituent. Some of you might be familiar with him, Mr. Larry Thorpe. He's an attorney in Springfield. It answers a particular problem that his firm has run up against. And I'd like to read a letter which I've reproduced, and you should have a copy, which explains the situation more clearly than any testimony I could produce of my own. Mr. Thorpe says in his letter, pertaining to Section 1 of the bill, my office represents several multi-employer, collectively bargained trust funds, such as pension and health and welfare plans sponsored by various unions. As you probably know, the way in which these plans function is that a collectively bargained agreement is negotiated between a union and an employer, pursuant to which the employer is required to make certain contributions, normally on a monthly basis, to the trustees of the plan. The contributions are used to provide pension or health and welfare benefits for the union members. The trustees, who represent management and labor equally, are required by federal law to use reasonable efforts to collect these contributions for the benefit of the plan participants. ORS 87855 was enacted in 1963 to allow such trust funds to file liens against the assets of the contributing employers who fail to make contributions, as required by the collective bargaining agreement. If the employer still fails to make the contributions, the lien may be foreclosed to collect the amounts due. In 1981, for reasons that are unclear, an amendment was made to ORS 87855. I'm jumping down to the bottom of page 2. The lien created by ORS 87855 does not deal with any type of federal lien. The amendment that was put into the statute in 1981 links a federal lien to this state lien. The main body of the statute merely creates a lien on behalf of private parties similar to a construction lien. House Bill 2914 would delete the language that was added in 1981. The language that he's speaking to is a language on line 5 of the bill that reads, not subject to ORS 87806 to 87831. So it's removing an exception that accepts certain employers from the vulnerability they may otherwise have to this lien for not paying their assessment on time. And I've attached on the back of the testimony copies of the statutes that we're speaking of. The last two pages of the testimony. The first page shows the Uniform Federal Tax Lien Registration Act, and the second page shows the next set of statutes, which is the lien for contributions to employee benefit plans, and the third line on that, 87855, contains the phrase we're deleting, not subject to ORS 87806 to 87831, which is contained in the previous page's statutes regarding Uniform Federal Tax Lien Registration Act. So what happens is, if someone is subject to the Uniform Tax Lien Registration Act, they are exempted from the possibility of having a lien placed on them for not contributing to an employee benefit plan. Mr. Thorpe was unable to find out why this was put into the law. He contacted the person who introduced the change in 1981 and was unable to determine why this change was made. It is does not make sense to have this reference in there to create this exception. The second part of the bill, Section 2, makes an amendment to ORS 87860, since we're dealing with that statute. The provision requires that a claim of lien be filed within 60 days after a payment becomes due. Normally, payments become due monthly. Therefore, if an employer is delinquent, the trustees generally attempt to work with the employer to resolve the problem. Unfortunately, the clock continues to tick, and very often, by the time the trustees determine that they have to file their claim for a lien, there may have been several months that have elapsed. It is presently unclear whether the statute applies to only payments coming due during the 60 days prior to filing the claim for a lien, or whether it extends to all contributions due during the period of delinquency, so long as a lien is filed within 60 days of the last delinquency. The modification proposed will clarify this ambiguity. The amendment makes it clear that the lien applies to all delinquencies so long as the most recent delinquency is within 60 days prior to the lien filing. If the trustees fail to file their lien within 60 days after the most recent delinquency, then, like any other lien right, they would be lost. An employer can truncate the lien liability also by simply making the current payments for 2 months. This change allows the trustees to work with delinquent employers without jeopardizing their lien rights. It adds more flexibility to the trustee's ability to work with the employer who's delinquent. That's the content of the bill. It passed the House 59-1, and I hope I can gain support of the committee and the Senate floor. I might comment, Mr. Chairman. What I've attached to the testimony is Mr. Thorpe's letter explaining the purpose of the bill. Also, a letter sent to Senator John Powell concerning the change in 1981, speaking to that bill. And on the second page of that letter, there's an area that's marked, which speaks to the change, the phrase that was inserted in 1981 that we're proposing to delete. It does nothing to explain why the phrase was inserted in 87855. It just does not explain anything. And it appears to be unrelated to the main purpose of that bill in 1981. And also, I've attached a letter from Mr. Thorpe to Stephen Shepard, who I believe worked for the bill in 1981, asking for an explanation. And Mr. Shepard responded by phone and was unable to explain why that change was made. So we're unable to find any reason why that change would be made. And finally, I've attached a copy of Section 8 of the bill that was adopted in 1981 with the original language. So you may see the bill in its form in 1981.
Any questions? Representative Hume?
I got one.
Okay, Senator Waters.
Did you ask former Senator Powell if he knew why this change was made?
Senator Powell was asked by Mr. Thorpe, and he had no recollection of the bill whatsoever. There's nothing in the legislative history to indicate why this change was made. And we've been unable to find what purpose it could have.
So. Okay. All right. Thanks. All right, Representative Hill is the only witness on this bill, so we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2914. Larry, we've got a Senate floor session going on, that's why we don't have a full complement here. Now, well, let's take care of... Let's take care of House Bill 2205. We have 12 full witnesses signed up on this. I suppose all four of them are sitting together back there. And I'll let you decide among yourselves who's going to be first. Toby Gaff's on here, Millie Cormack's on here, Fred Merrill's on here, and Jim Nass is on here. However you people want to work it out.
Mr. Chairman, I was given the dubious honor of going first. My name is James Nass, legal counsel to the Supreme Court of Appeals. House Bill 2205 is the product of about 2 years worth of a file that I kept at the request of the Chief Judge. He said, keep track of any glitches that you find, which I did. And when this session came around, I helped in the drafting of this bill that resolves many of those. We regard many of them as housekeeping type of measures, and I have submitted detailed testimony on each section, but what I'd like to do is pass over that and just go to those sections that I believe are
call the Senate. All right, we'll take a recess and we'll be right back, I hope. And I'll explain to the members of the audience who are familiar with this procedure where they're subject to being called back upon motion of two members of the Senate for the purpose of having our votes recorded on something. And when that happens, we have to leave, so that's what we're doing.
Previously called me at about 1 minute after five and asked me if it had been filed. And to my knowledge, it hasn't been filed. But there was an opinion of the...
Go back and regulate. All right, now the Senate Judiciary Committee is back in session. It is 7 p.m. We have been upstairs on call for 55 minutes. As I recall, it was about 5 minutes to six when we left. And all of that time, I'm saying this for the benefit of the patient audience, all of that time we were listening to a lot of talk about one bill, just one bill, and one of the very longest talkers was a Senate critic of the fact that the Judiciary Committee does not hear every single bill, every single one of the 300 and some bills that we get. Probably one reason we don't hear over 300 bills is because we don't have the time. And of course, when somebody talks a long time on something, why, that even reduces our chances of getting more done. But we're back here again. We'll probably, we have to return at 7:15, so we're not going to be able to stay here very long. Well, I mean, the whole committee, I can stay, but the president wants most of the people back at 7:15, so you have a quorum.
So let's give a recess or something?
Yeah, we're on recess. We're on recess right now at 7:15. Anyway, we have... we are working on...
House Bill 2205.
2205.
Mr. Nass is up.
And he is the first of four witnesses on this bill. And then we have one other bill.
We've got one... Two other bills.
Yeah, we've only got witnesses signed up on the...
Diana Godwin wanted to testify in 2007, and I'm just right here.
Diana Godwin still there?
She was out in the hall.
Okay. Anyway, go ahead, Mr. Nass.
The most significant section of the bill probably is Section 5, particularly Subsection 2 of it. Subsection 2 relates to service of a notice of appeal on adverse parties. Under existing law, in order to have a timely and proper appeal, you have to serve a copy of the notice of appeal on every single party who appeared at trial. Under our bill, you'd only have to serve the parties identified as adverse parties on the appeal.
Now, this is the House bill that is
this is the House version of the bill we couldn't seem to put together over here.
Right, Senate Bill 99, you've already dealt with this issue in that bill. The other witnesses will be speaking to this section, so I will pass on unless you have any questions about that.
No questions, Mr. Mass. All right, fine. Now you might just remain handy here, and then Fred, you're going next.
Yes, it's just over. I meant about that section. I was going to pass on to other sections unless you had any questions.
Okay, go ahead.
There's just one or two others I wanted to make.
Yes, go ahead.
Reference to. Subsection 5, subsection 4 of section 5 is a new section that would permit the appellate court to give the trial court leave to correct errors in judgments that frequently under existing law necessitate us to dismiss appeals, get them back to the trial court, enter a new judgment, and then bring them back up again. And the appellant has to pay another $100 filing fee, and they frequently foul up a second time. What we're trying to do here is to put a stop to all that and to give the appellate courts and the trial courts the power to just simply say, okay, but they stopped. We have a technical defect in the judgment. We're going to send this matter back to the trial court by way of motion, get whatever the drafting or scrivener or clerical error is, we'll clear it up, and then send a copy of it back up to the appellate court and get the appeal back on track. I would note that we are in this bill eliminating the $100 filing fee for four categories of cases. We do not anticipate any financial impact on us, at least not any negative one, since it costs us more to process applications for fee waivers than we ever collect from the fees from those that we waive. At two points in my written testimony, I recommend that there be certain amendments to the bill. And in further reviewing the bill, I've decided that those are not really necessary and would not offer them at this time. And that's all I have, unless you have any questions.
Okay. Thank you. Well, all right. All right, Fred Merrill, you next.
Yes, yeah, you next. Members of the committee, Fred Merrill, University of Oregon School of Law. I'm appearing today on behalf of the Oregon State Bar Procedure and Practice Committee. The committee generally favors the housekeeping elements of this bill, but voted this spring to suggest a change which would appear in Section 5 of the bill relating to those matters that are jurisdictional in perfecting an appeal. Under the present system, service on all parties is required. Section 5 would change this, as Mr. Mass indicated, to service on all parties identified in the notice of appeal as adverse parties. The Committee on Practice and Procedure wishes to change this so that the only thing that would be jurisdictional, that is, that would automatically result in dismissal without any discretion on the part of the Court of Appeals, would be the filing of a notice of appeal indicating the title of the court and the name of the case in the Court of Appeals, and that all other considerations, including the service of the notices, would be treated as other things are presently, such as the filing of a bond. They could be cause for dismissal if there was material prejudice, but they would not automatically result in a dismissal. The reason for doing this was it was called to the committee's attention that there was and this is just an example, a case that resulted in a malpractice claim filed with the State Malpractice Insurance Board, where an attorney was handling a very significant case that had a large number of parties, and there had been two parties about 3 or 4 years earlier who had been formally named, who had appeared and then had been immediately dismissed, and everyone had dropped their names out of the caption in the pleadings, and when he filed a notice of appeal, he did not serve these two people, and the appeal was dismissed, the entire appeal. And a very substantial malpractice claim was filed on that basis.
Why does so much this testimony? Why does so much this testimony sound like something we've heard before this session? Was there another bill that had some?
Yes, we had. We kicked around a Senate bill on the same subject, and then couldn't. Never could get together with the language.
I thought we had dealt with this issue, but we didn't put that bill out.
No, because they finally decided that they couldn't do it, and they said they were going to work on it in the House.
So they got something together at the House, but now Mr. Merrill,
yeah,
wasn't part of the. Could I ask a question?
Go ahead and ask a question.
Mr. Merrill, when this was worked out in the House, were you busy with your duties, or did you make the point there? I don't mean any disrespect.
Yeah, right. No, the committee voted to take this approach and drafted a bill. And the bill was submitted, as all state bar bills are, to the Bar Legislative Committee, who authorized that it go forward this session rather than in an attempt to take care of this session rather than wait till the next legislative session. By the time that was done, the work, I gather, had been done on this bill in the House, and this is the first opportunity we have had to ask for these amendments. So we have submitted them by a letter to the counsel for the committee from Mark B. Comstock, a member of the committee, in the form of amendments to 2205. In other words, the committee had adopted this bill, but it took place late enough that it wouldn't have gotten into this legislative session. And the state bar legislative committee decided.
I'm referring to whatever happened in the House when this bill was patched up in the House.
Did you offer those amendments in the House?
No, they were not offered in the House because they had not been apparently approved by the legislative committee of the bar at that time. So this is the first call I had at all relating to presenting this.
Mr. Chair, you had mentioned that, and other members had, that we've heard this before. I can remember a gentleman older than myself from Portland, from a very large firm, actually crying in front of the Judiciary Committee one time, maybe 15 years ago, because of the draconian effect of a defect in the notice of appeal. He had not sent the money. He had sent the appeal, but not the filing fee, and the statute threw him out of court. The question should be whether we amend the bill so that only something that really matters is jurisdictional in order to avoid the malpractice and, more importantly, the inconvenience to the client trying to appeal. There has been a history here of the notice of appeal being unbelievably strict on the question of jurisdiction. I think we ought to take his amendments and go ahead with them. I don't think they'll hurt a thing. The appellate court can protect itself, the other party can protect itself. Whether we've heard him or not, it doesn't sound like the House Committee had his approach at the time.
Well, I'm glad you said that. I wasn't mean, I didn't like his ideas or think we should consider them. I guess it's because we had the Senate vote before. It's late in the afternoon, and I'm kind of having trouble tracking here. Right. It reminds me of the time that President Fleming made his first speech at the University of Oregon, and there was an echo, and he got auditory feedback at the football game where he was sitting at the bowl game, and people thought he was intoxicated. He didn't drink. I don't think.
It was just deja vu fever.
Yeah, it was just after he'd gotten all his problems with cranberry juice.
That's what he was drinking.
Excuse me.
And then I'll try.
Okay, any other questions? All right, fine. Now, we have Toby Graffs here and Melvin Cormack, and I guess, Toby, you're going to have to be next.
Senator Fry, members of the committee, my name's Toby Graff. I'm an attorney in private practice in Portland, specializing in appellate work. I'm appearing here to urge the adoption of HB 20, 2205 with the amendments proposed by the Procedure and Practice Committee of the Bar. I won't repeat the earlier testimony. I would like to emphasize a couple of points. The main problem, of course, has been that a party who fails to serve, an appellant who fails to serve, a party who appeared below will automatically have his appeal dismissed once that fact, the service defect, is brought to the attention of the court. The Section 5 of 2205 attempts to ameliorate or mitigate the effects of a service defect by giving the appellant an alternative. Either he can serve everybody who appeared below, or he can serve those persons he designates as adverse parties in his notice of appeal. There used to be similar statutory requirement in 1973 of serving all adverse parties. It generated a tremendous amount of litigation in trying to determine who was adverse and who wasn't. And indeed, that litigation was one of the factors that led the legislature in 1973 to dispense with the requirement of serving adverse parties and replace it with a requirement of serving everybody who had appeared before.
p.m. now, and the Senate Judiciary Committee is back in session. Senator Fye is a subcommittee of one to hear public testimony, and we will go to House Bill 2016.
I have with me, I have 15 copies turned in.
Good evening. My name is Paul Osman, and on my right is William Schatzer. I'm a deputy city attorney from the City of Portland, and Mr. Schatzer is a code hearings officer for the City of Portland. We're here this evening to testify in favor of House Bill 2016, which amends...
Which one?
I've got three or four.
It's the grandparent.
Oh, grandparent.